intelligence reduction is made. I'm going to call the first case 99-2189 CR, State v. Dunlap, arguing for the state of Wisconsin is Assistant Attorney General Marguerite Mueller.
Good morning. May it please the court. Not a remarkable one, insofar as it involves a 50-year-old male charged with fondling a 6-year-old's vagina. This case is also not remarkable in that there was not a single eyewitness to the crime and no physical evidence that the assault occurred. What is remarkable is that the state was able to obtain a conviction even though the charged offense occurred almost 9 years prior to Dunlap's trial. And what is even more remarkable is that the Court of Appeals, which reversed Mr. Dunlap's conviction not once, but on 2 occasions, seemed to search for ways to find that clearly inadmissible evidence of the 6-year-old victim's sexual conduct predating the charged assault was admissible, so that exclusion of this evidence was found to have violated Dunlap's constitutional right to present a defense.
Counsel, just a question factually. There was an 8-year gap, almost 8.5 years, and after reading the record, it didn't make it clear whether the alleged perpetrator knew that there was this warrant. Was this happen chance that he possibly did not know? He left the state under normal circumstances and was apprehended 8.5 years later.
There was conflicting evidence. The state's evidence would indicate that he intentionally fled the state because after he left, he changed his name from Charles Dunlap to Charlie Dancing Eagle, and he also used a different date of birth. If you look at the complaint, it would indicate that he was almost 50 when the charged crime occurred, and then at the time he was picked up, he used a birth date 6 years earlier. There was also testimony from one of the persons with whom he was staying in Wisconsin that he had actually confronted Mr. Dunlap about the allegation before he left the state. But if you take the defendant's testimony, he claimed that he had always been planning to leave and was simply waiting for some car parts to come in so that he could drive back to Colorado. So there was a conflict there, but the state's view was that it was evidence of flight and consciousness of guilt. If one examines the Court of Appeals' opinion in isolation, the result that the court reached would appear to be reasonable. The opinion makes it sound as if the state presented evidence that 6-year-old Jamie exhibited bizarre behaviors after the time of the charged assault, and that this abnormal behavior was used as proof that, in fact, Charles Dunlap was her assailant. Now, what is conjured up, at least in my mind, when the phrase abnormal behavior is used, is behavior of sexually precocious conduct with playmates or with toys, or bedwetting, stuttering, types of behavior that was not present prior to the charged assault, but that suddenly surfaced. The impression left by the Court of Appeals' opinion is that the state presented evidence from an expert that Jamie exhibited very bizarre behavior after the date of the charged assault, November 7th of 1989, but that Dunlap was then not allowed to present similar types of evidence showing that she had exhibited the same type or similar types of bizarre behavior before the date of the charged assault. But if you read the testimony of both the victim, Jamie, and of Teresa Hansen, the child protective services worker called by the state, it is clear that that is not what happened here and that the Court of Appeals' opinion presents a very misleading picture of how this evidence came in and what it was used for.
Well, wasn't the proffered evidence basically all of the conduct happened prior to the alleged, I mean, the conduct that the defense wanted to get in was prior to the alleged incident. In other words, the dog incident and others, well, that was all prior.
Correct. The defendant wanted to put on evidence of her sexual conduct before November 7th. And I'm sorry, I must have missed the last part of your
question. No, that's, but I just wanted to note that when you said that, maybe I misunderstood your statement, but as I understand it, all of the conduct that they wanted to get in that they felt was for the jury to hear was prior to, and that came from the statement of Susan Smith, who was deceased.
That's correct. All of the defense proffered evidence was prior to November 7th. The state's evidence was after. But my point is that the type of evidence that was presented by the state did not really go to any kind of bizarre behavior. What it went to was testimony by an expert explaining why certain facets of the child's reporting behavior or her post-assault conduct was not an indication that she was lying or making up the fact that this assault had occurred. And the reason that testimony became necessary was that when the defense attorney cross-examined Jamie, he got her to admit that she had changed her version of the assault in some respects. For example, at the time she made her statement back in 1989, she indicated that a teenager named Sean was present in the house when the assault occurred, but that 8 years later when she testified at the preliminary trial, she indicated that she and the defendant were alone. Similarly, when she first gave her statement to the Child Protective Services worker, she indicated that the defendant had not inserted his fingers in her vagina, but then when she testified, she said that he did. And the goal of the defense in drawing out these inconsistencies was to suggest that this could not have happened because of these inconsistencies, and also that she acted in a fashion that one would not expect a victim to. She admitted in her cross-examination that she returned to the residence where the assault occurred after it had happened, and the defense tried to have the jury draw the inference that this was not normal behavior. In response to this, the state called Teresa Hansen, who had interviewed the child, and he also, the prosecutor, had her discuss various aspects of reporting behavior and to explain why these were not necessarily inconsistent with a child being assaulted, or why a six-year-old might not understand the difference between inside and out when you're referring to genitalia, or why she would not be definite on whether a particular person was in the house or was not in the house. So the type of evidence that the state put on did not have to do with any kind of abnormal or bizarre behavior that the child exhibited that would be considered to be a red flag indicating that because she was having these problems, this meant that she was in fact a victim of sexual assault. And I think it's important to distinguish between these two types of evidence because it directly affects the relevance of the type of evidence.
I'm sorry, Ms. Muller, explain to me again, if you would, what are the two different kinds of evidence. Now, I understand one is to explain the reporting behavior or failure to report the sexual assault. That's one. That's the Jensen evidence. Is that right?
Some of Teresa Hansen's testimony would be regarded as Jensen, but not all of it, because.
Okay. But is that what you mean by Jensen testimony, the reporting issue?
Jensen testimony normally would be defined, in my opinion, as talking about various behaviors of a child that are normally observed in assault victims, and then showing that the child in this particular case behaved consistently with what is known about the behavior of other child sexual assault victims. And it doesn't have to be reporting behavior.
Okay.
That's
mm-hmm.
one facet of Jensen evidence. But it can be more directly, I guess you could use the word diagnostic, of the fact that sexual abuse occurred. And I
think so when Hansen testified that Jamie's conduct of fidgeting, putting her hands in her mouth, kicking the table, and stating what she didn't want to talk about, that would be Jensen testimony as consistent behavior of sexual assault victims.
I think that was probably one of the two answers that she gave that would qualify as Jensen, because she specifically tied behavior of known sexual assault victims to what the child here exhibited. In a lot of the other examples, the trial court made it clear that she was only testifying as to six-year-old children in general, and she never made the ultimate comparison. In other words, she was not asked, well, can you explain why Jamie might have said at the time in 1989 that he did not insert his fingers, and then 9 years later she's saying he did. So in that respect, she just gave general testimony that a six-year-old wouldn't have the experience to know the difference.
Okay, so what's the other kind of evidence? We now got Jensen down.
Well, I think it's all comes under the umbrella of Jensen evidence, and it just goes to whether you're really trying to use the evidence as direct proof, direct link, that the assault occurred. In other words, if the state, the best case for the defense here would have been if the state had put on evidence from Teresa Hansen that after this charged assault, Teresa Hansen had evidence that this girl was engaging in inappropriate sexual behavior with her playmates or her toys. And then the state would say, but Mr. Dunlap, you're not allowed to put on any evidence to show that before the charged assault, she was doing the same or similar kinds of things. That would be the best case for the defense. And an intermediate case...
Well, why isn't that behavior to show what a victim of criminal assault is? It is, right?
Well, I think it shows circumstantially. It helps the state's case circumstantially, because any time you're doing something to build up the credibility of the victim, then necessarily it's a link in the chain of evidence. And I think it maybe it's unfortunate that in my brief I characterized it as substantive evidence, and that was not a well-chosen word. I think it's better to characterize it in terms of how far removed is it in this whole evidentiary chain to show that the assault occurred. Now, certainly, because the goal of the defense was to show she must be lying, because anybody who was sexually assaulted wouldn't go back to the same house where the incident occurred a day later, or they wouldn't confuse details about whether somebody was in the house or somebody wasn't. So insofar as the state used Teresa Hansen to explain why that wouldn't disprove the truth of her allegations, then circumstantially, yes, it does go to prove that the assault occurred, because it's bolstering her credibility. But we're not talking about the kind of evidence that occurred in Jensen itself, where there were really two types of reactive behavior talked about, and one of them was behavior that sends up a red flag, an indicator that because you've got a child who suddenly is acting provocatively, wearing tight clothes, flirting with boys, asking sexually precocious questions in health class, that those are indicators something has happened to her. And I think that if you can analogize this to medical testimony by a doctor, maybe that puts it in a better light. If you had a situation where a doctor was testifying that a little girl had a torn hymen, well, certainly the state would say, well, this shows you that she was sexually assaulted. And if the timing of this discovery that she had this medical condition was right after the defendant assaulted her, well, then certainly that would go a long way to showing that this was the person who caused the injury. And in that case, certainly the state should not be able to prevent the defense from showing that she had this medical condition before the charged assault occurred. Therefore, it's likely somebody else besides the defendant caused it. On the other hand, if you had an expert medical witness testify after the defense had presented evidence that there was no evidence of injury despite an assault, and the state put on an expert to say, Well, just because there wasn't an injury does not mean that a sexual assault didn't occur, that in that sense, there's nothing inconsistent with lack of an injury and the truth of the statement, then there would be far less relevance in the defense putting on some kind of evidence that before the charged assault, the child had engaged in some kind of sexual conduct.
Counsel, the Court of Appeals relies, as I read the opinion, on at least two, maybe three bases of admissibility. And in looking at the concluding paragraph, and the discussion beforehand, they say the state opened the door. That's what we're talking about here. And then third, they say the evidence meets the five-part Polizzano test. What's the relationship of those two independent bases of admissibility?
Well, in this particular case, there is a close relationship because this was not a situation in which the defense ever brought any kind of a pretrial motion suggesting that there was evidence of prior sexual conduct that either would fit one of the exceptions of the rape shield law or that even though normally it would be inadmissible, would come in under Polizzano. There never was any mention of Polizzano.
You note that in your brief. Nevertheless, the Court of Appeals goes through the Polizzano analysis. I guess what I'm saying, you know, opening the door, Court of Appeals says, you open the door, fundamental fairness, due process allows the admissibility of it. And another area of inquiry as to admissibility is, do you meet the five-part Polizzano test? Okay. If the defense prevails on the state open the door, do we then go to the five-part Polizzano test? If the defense loses, do we then go to the five-part Polizzano test? Are each independent, or is there an interrelationship?
Well, I think if you conclude, as I've argued, that there was no opening of the door,
yes,
then I think that ends it, because trial counsel, or actually, I believe it was trial counsel, Mr. Johnson, stated that we wouldn't be arguing that this stuff would come in, except for the fact that Teresa Hansen opened the door.
Why isn't your argument, well, I don't know if we opened the door or not, but it doesn't meet the five-part Polizzano test.
Well, that's an alternative way. I think this court has many ways in which it could reverse the Court of Appeals. And I think one of them is to say there was no opening of the door. The Court of Appeals was equating apples with oranges when it said that the kind of evidence the state put on somehow made this evidence of pre-assault sexual conduct relevant. But I also think that the court could find that even if the state did open the door, you still have to look at things like hearsay. It doesn't necessarily mean that just because the state opened the door to a certain kind of evidence that the defense is able to get into inadmissible hearsay, and it also doesn't mean that you can get into evidence that violates the rape shield law and does not satisfy the five-part test of Polizzano, let alone show that even if the five-part test had been satisfied, that the state didn't have a compelling reason for keeping out this kind of testimony. I mean, you can satisfy Polizzano, and under this court's decision, that doesn't necessarily end the inquiry, as we know from, you know, other cases, that the state still could have a compelling reason in a given case to, if you want to use the word trump, the defendant's right to put on evidence. But I think here you could say very easily the door was never opened, because this kind of evidence that the state put on was simply to educate the jury that just because this is how the girl reported or this is the way a six-year-old explained the assault, that doesn't mean that this could not have occurred the way she said it did, because that's the impression that the defense attorney wanted to leave with the jury. So I think you've got all of those. And I think it's striking here that the Court of Appeals, it just seemed, was searching for a way to overturn this conviction. I mean, the Court of Appeals issued an opinion on August 2nd in which it said that even though the testimony that the defense wanted to introduce, and remember, they wanted to introduce this by cross-examining Teresa Hansen about a report that was made to her by Susan Smith, who had since died. They wanted to get into that, even though Smith's statement was clearly hearsay. And the Court of Appeals said, well, it was hearsay, but under 90703, it was the basis for the expert's opinion, and an expert is allowed to use hearsay in formulating an opinion. That was their first opinion, which I didn't think, you know, really made a lot of sense, and apparently the Court of Appeals itself, upon reflection, didn't think it made a lot of sense either, because they withdrew that August 2nd opinion and reissued another opinion when they decided that Smith's statement to Teresa Hansen was classic hearsay. But despite the fact that it was classic hearsay, the court concluded that due process and fair play require the admission of a statement about Jamie's unusual behavior, which was observed before the alleged assault. The court never really explains, are they creating a due process exception to the hearsay rule? Or when they say that this is not the type of statement meant to be rigorously excluded by the hearsay rule, are they saying that the hearsay rule isn't hard and fast, and this evidence kind of is like the residual exception, even though they never cite the residual exception? You really don't know from the Court of Appeals' opinion.
So in their summary, though, they indicate sufficient indicia of reliability, which is the...
Well, they say there is some assurance that Smith's statement is trustworthy. And I guess I really dispute that, because the statement that Smith made was made on November 13, 1989, according to at least what the defense attorney represented. Hansen was never asked that question. If she makes the statement in the course of the investigation of this whole assault, I think there's a good question on whether she, at that point, she had some allegiance to the defendant. After all, he was living at the home that Susan Smith and Gary Cox shared. He had been a friend of theirs for years in Colorado. So you've got this motivation at the time she made the statement to make the little girl look as if, hey, she was sexually precocious, she was damaged goods. I just don't think that there is sufficient assurance of reliability to say that this falls within the residual hearsay exception. Certainly the court did not do, I believe it's a Sorensen analysis, where you go through the various factors.
Ms. Moeller, I'm not clear in my mind from the oral argument or the briefs exactly the kind of opinion you want. That if you were the state and you had the opportunity to write it, what you would write. Now, on page 24 of your brief, you say we ought to deal with Pulisano because the Court of Appeals, in a published opinion, has misapplied Pulisano. So I want you to very quickly write the beginning or concluding paragraphs of an opinion that you think repairs this Court of Appeals opinion.
Well, ideally, the state would like you to find that there was no opening of the door, but even if there had been an opening of the door...
What are we opening the door to?
Opening the door to otherwise barred testimony that would violate both the hearsay rule and...
The barred testimony is prior sexual activity.
Right, prior sexual activity of the six-year-old.
So there's no opening the door to bar to prior sexual activity. When and how would you characterize the state, what the state's evidence was?
When the state presented testimony from the expert witness to disabuse the jury about myths regarding reporting behavior or the cognitive ability of six-year-old victims. So that is where I would, you know, ask the court to start, that there was no concept of opening the door here. But to go on and say that even if the door had been opened somewhat, or if this evidence had minor relevance, it wasn't sufficient to overcome the hearsay rule, which I don't think the Court of Appeals really ever satisfactorily dealt with this. I mean, if you read that opinion, I think trial courts are going to be led to believe that there's some kind of a new hearsay exception grounded, generally speaking, in due process and fair play. Now, I realize that under cases like the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Chambers, that you can't apply a state's hearsay rule mechanistically to violate a defendant's constitutional rights. The Court of Appeals here isn't talking about Chambers. They're just saying, we think there is some guarantees of trustworthiness. So I think I would like the court to address that the Court of Appeals was wrong in saying that you get around the hearsay rule. But alternatively, I think you have to address the way they applied Polizzano, because they applied it so loosely, talking about how the conduct that the defense wanted to get into, and the court knows this involved precocious behavior of a child, that somehow closely resembled the Charge Act. The Charged Act was fondling her vagina, something that is not, you know, without the beyond the ken of a little girl to understand, especially when she talked about Charlie touched my private parts. There's nothing unusual about that would lead one to believe that, oh, she would never have this kind of source of sexual knowledge unless the defendant had done it. So I think the application of Polizzano is so loose here that if this decision is allowed to stand, I think it's going to eviscerate the rape shield law, because if you're saying that a child's behavior of simulating sex with a dog, trying to stimulate herself by sitting in somebody's lap, that closely resembles fondling of the vagina, I think that takes away entirely the meaning of the second Polizzano factor.
Is that the weakest link in Polizzano, the second factor?
I think it's probably one of the two weakest links. I think the whole idea that it was necessary to the defendant's case is just not really, doesn't hold up under close scrutiny. When you look at the fine cross-examination that defense counsel Johnson actually did with Teresa Hansen and with the victim. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Williams. Shire, Assistant Public Defender.
And please support Jack Shire representing Charles Dunlap.
Can you raise the podium, please? I think that'll help us hear you. That's right. Thank you.
Your Honor, the state in its brief has discussed at some length State versus Robinson, State versus Jensen, State versus Lamb in discussing information which is presented or can be presented to trial courts in sexual assault cases that serves to inform the jury or the trier of fact of misconceptions that may involve certain kinds of evidence. There was also a discussion of different types of evidence that was discussed in State versus Jensen. And in terms of State versus Jensen, there were so-called red flags, but there was evidence of particular conduct of the individual which certainly suggested a sexual assault. It's our position that the state and the state has claimed here that they were put by the Court of Appeals decision in an untenable position with regard to the presentation of evidence. I don't think this is correct. What happens generally in sexual assault cases, and did here to a point, was that evidence is presented of the conduct, general conduct of sexual assault victims. And this evidence included evidence that certain individuals may not be aware at the age of six of the concept of in and out. And there was a whole series of them that Ms. Mueller has identified. However, the state went beyond this. This is discussed at page 6 of the state's brief. There's two specific instances that are referred to. One is the discussion of the disclosure of information to a trusted person, which would be her mother, at a location away from the home where the assault was perpetrated. And the other had to do with the child's conversation with Teresa Hansen, who was a child protective worker from Walworth County, in which she fidgeted, kicked her feet under the table, and performed other conduct, which, in fact, suggested that she was, that was consistent with a sexual assault victim. I think it's important to note that there was no limited purpose for the admissibility of this evidence that the state raised at the time of its introduction, nor was there any cautionary instruction which would tell the jury or trier of fact, as often is done, for instance, in a other acts situation, that it's for only considered for a limited purpose. Therefore, I think a juror could reasonably understand in this case that those, that type of information, the state's brief uses the term substantive evidence, but if it's just simply part of their proof or whatever, could be considered in terms of the guilt or innocence.
Mr. Scherer, did anyone ask for a cautionary instruction?
No. There was no request. In terms of the situation, the defense tried to introduce evidence that would show an alternative source of knowledge that, in fact, prior to this sexual assault, Jamie Duff, the complainant, had been observed in unusual behavior, humping dogs, riding.
Isn't that standard in a sexual assault case for the defense? You know, want to show that type of conduct by the
Your Honor, I think if there is conduct that would show some valid purpose, I would think the defense would try to do that.
But my question is, how would this fit under second prong of Polizano? In other words, isn't this, we had an alleged sexual assault versus this conduct of the six-year-old?
Well, it's my position, Your Honor, that Polizano does not apply in opening the door. First of all, by definition, opening the door involves a concept of fair play. In other words, this is cited in Coogan, referred to in the briefs, Court of Appeals decision in Jackson. What's happened is this court and the Court of Appeals, in a post-Polizano case involving opening the door, involving the Rape Shield Act in State versus Jackson, neither court applied Polizano at all in that regard. In fact, there was a reference to that in dissent by Judge Brown in the Court of Appeals decision in Jackson. And I think it's counterintuitive. The entire purpose, in other words, opening the door means that otherwise inadmissible evidence can be admitted because the state has referred to it. I've mentioned a case called Commonwealth versus Riley, which is from Pennsylvania, which involved the Rape Shield Act. There was a reference to sexual conduct in direct examination. The court found essentially opening the door relieved a rape shield bar. So therefore, I don't think that there's any such requirement, and I think that the Court of Appeals was wrong in applying it.
I just have to ask you a question. I want to specifically, what particular language opened the door? What language, what question opened the door?
Your Honor,
I want to know what it opened the door to. Then I want to know why your evidence is relevant and relevant to what. Okay?
Your Honor, I believe that the language about the person disclosing to a trusted person away from the location of the home, which would be consistent was the behavior of a sexual assault victim operated to open the door, as well as her discussions with Teresa Hansen.
Can I just, Counsel, I didn't catch that one. Go over that one again. In other words, this person away from the open, what was
In other words, the young girl, Jamie F., disclosing to her mother,
that she was
a trusted person away from the home, was consistent with the behavior of a sexual assault victim, and that she discussed with Teresa Hansen, who was the child protective worker, her behavior in the discussion with her after the incident, which showed reticence in terms of dealing with these issues, was consistent with a sexual assault. Therefore, it was particular to this individual. And I believe it opened the door because there was other behavior, which was the behavior involving prior to the incident, which involved the sexual behavior, which was also consistent with that of a sexual assault victim. It's obvious that a person who is 6 years old and is engaging in these types of behaviors.
Well, you were trying to show, I gather, defense was trying to show, that she had had previous sexual experiences, right? Before, sexual knowledge, before the asserted incident here. What's the point of that? What does that do for your defendant? How does that show guilt or innocence?
This is a situation, Your Honor, where Charles Dunlap had only come to this area very recently, within 7 years. And what it basically shows is that there was another explanation for the child's for sexual knowledge that this child would have. And therefore, that, in fact, the jury was entitled to consider whether this was information which, in fact, was consistent with that of a sexual assault victim. As a matter of fair play, just was entitled to consider the other evidence that the state had presented.
Okay, so suppose she had sexual knowledge elsewhere. How does that affect the guilt of your client?
What that does, Your Honor, is it suggests that the complaining witness, in all of the testimony that she's given, suggests that Charles Dunlap assaulted her, and that she would have other information from another source which would possibly explain how she would know about this type of behavior, now, which would be unusual for a six-year-old child. And I believe that what is at issue here is, again, a classic source of knowledge. And, for instance, in Pulisano itself, there was an effort to get in information about MD, which was a young child, which there was an allegation that this lady had had sexual contact with. And the court found that that was a source of knowledge and it was important evidence. And ultimately, it was, as we know, the Pulisano decision involved the overriding of the sexual, of the rape shield law under those circumstances. Now, Your Honor, I think it's very important.
I want to stay on this for just a second.
Yeah, sure.
What is it about, and this is a follow-up to the Chief's question, what is it about Ms. Hansen's testimony that would indicate to the jury that the child, that this Jamie had been sexually abused, as distinguished from what the state argues, that Ms. Hansen's testimony was nothing more than testimony designed to educate the jury, was in an area in which the jury might have, in which the common behavior of an abused child is counterintuitive to what a jury might ordinarily believe. What is it about, well, I think you understand the question.
Your Honor, the situation is, this is not a general statement about behavior of sexual assault victims. What would be presented here?
Well, what is it in Ms. Hansen's statement that you're saying is not simply educative?
What I'm saying is that this information suggests a source of knowledge other than Mr. Dunlap. In other words, the information that is provided is specific to this individual, unlike most of the information that is provided by Teresa Hansen. There is information here which goes to whether this behavior is consistent with a sexual assault victim, and that's why.
Well, maybe I simply misunderstand the record, but as I understand it, Ms. Hansen simply testified that a child who has been sexually abused exhibits certain type of behavior, and at least arguably did not make any connection with this victim, but simply said these are the normal characteristics of a child abuse victim.
Now, there are two questions, Your Honor, which specifically referred to the behavior of Jamie F.
What were
consistent with a sexual assault victim.
What were those?
Those had to do with disclosure to a trusted person away from the area where the assault occurred, and her behavior in discussing the incident with child protective worker Teresa Hansen. And therefore, since it was specific to the defendant, specific to the child in this case, the defense, therefore, as a matter of fairness, said we should be able to get in this information, which is specific to this child, which also indicates that this is behavior consistent with somebody who's sexually assaulted, that they were assaulted before, and therefore would indicate an alternative source of knowledge.
Was there any evidence in the record that she had been previously sexually assaulted?
There was no specific evidence that she had been previously sexually assaulted.
As I understand this, this is a case about the defensive use of Jensen evidence. I mean, analytically, that's what this case is about. The defensive use of Jensen evidence. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, what we're saying is that if Jensen evidence comes in for one side, and it should fairly come in.
Well, we have an issue about whether the state introduced Jensen evidence in the first instance here. And Jensen evidence, as I have always understood it, is not evidence about the circumstances under which the victim reported the crime. In other words, Jensen evidence does not include testimony about how and when the victim reports. That's not Jensen evidence. And that's very clear from the Jensen opinion, because the defendant in the Jensen case wasn't arguing that that part of the social worker's testimony was at issue. In fact, it's specifically excluded from being at issue. So, but what you're trying to do is defensively use Jensen evidence here. And I think you said that that was a fair characterization of what the defense seeks in this case, is a ruling on the defensive use of Jensen evidence.
I want to make sure I understand correctly your interpretation of Jensen evidence. But it would be my understanding that where Jensen evidence, there's two types which have been discussed by Ms. Mahler in her brief, which I think. That type which involves specific behavior of the complainant or the victim, that in fact that evidence can, depending on what it is and the circumstances, be evidence that can be used to suggest to a trier of fact the defendant.
Counsel, your answers are fading out to me.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I think there's one of the problems in this case and the next one is what exactly is Jensen evidence? And I have never understood Jensen evidence to include that category of evidence which pertains to how and when a victim reports. And the very common
evidence about whether or not the manner in which the victim in this case reported, in other words, reporting delays, what they specifically report as having happened to them, etc., and whether that's consistent with how sex assault victims report. I have never understood that to be Jensen evidence, and I think the Jensen case specifically says that's not what's at issue. In fact, the opinion says very clearly that the defendant is only challenging the expert's testimony of the victim's acting out behaviors, the bizarre sexual acting out behaviors. That was the only thing that was at issue. There was some of the other kind of testimony in that case, but that's not what the Jensen ruling is all about. What you're talking about here is wanting to get Jensen evidence into the record for defensive purposes to suggest that the victim was previously sexually assaulted, and that's why I asked the question that I did. Was there any affirmative evidence that the victim was previously sexually assaulted? Because that's the only way Jensen would come in, Jensen evidence would come in as corroboration for that.
Well, Your Honor, I think my position is, understanding of Jensen is different respectfully from yours. Because I submit that if the state goes beyond the general area of discussion of evidence that is consistent with a sexual assault thing and goes to specific evidence, which with regard to that particular individual, the defense, and the common denominator being consistency with a sexual assault, the defense should therefore, that has opened the door to other evidence with regard to behavior consistent with sexual assault victim.
Counsel, that's exactly what happened in the Land and the Jensen case. Isn't this what Justice Sykes was talking about? That's what went on. So you're saying any time a expert gets up to rehabilitate, that would open... I don't see the bright line between what...
Between that evidence, Your Honor, which is general or generic, that evidence which suggests...
If they refer to... obviously, they're there, and they have to talk about what testimony. So if there's any reference to this particular incident, then that opens the door?
I think it involves the particular individual, one, and two, the behavior is consistent with a sexual assault victim. Once you do that, and you make it very specific...
But then you want us to really overturn. I mean, pretty frankly, because that's what I thought the Jensen and the Lamb cases were all about.
No, I don't, Your Honor. I'm simply dealing with opening the door. It seems the whole concept of this evidence is once you present this evidence, once you, quote, open the door... The defense can then come in and present other evidence, which is material and relevant, which we submit this is. Now, the problem here is the state is not prohibited from, in other words, the state could have entirely presented evidence that generally sexual assault victims do A, B, C, D, and E. But when they get into where they have a problem, where they get into the specific individual and the consistency with sexual assault victims with no limitation, and the jury has no information that they have a limited purpose for this evidence, it's our position that that's where the state, as a matter of fairness, the defense, in terms of their right to make a defense, as a matter of fairness, should get this in.
Counsel, in your earlier comments, I think you cited the case of Commonwealth versus Riley, which I've not read, for the premise that if the state opens the door, then there is no Polizzano test that has to be met. That rape shield bar does not exist.
Yes.
Now, it seems to me that premise is pretty important for your case. I understood, did you cite some additional authority besides Commonwealth versus...
Yeah, Your Honor, we're talking about this court. There is very little case law dealing with this, which involves both an opening the door issue and a rape shield issue that is post-Pulisano. And the Court of Appeals and the Wisconsin Supreme Court in State versus Jackson dealt with these matters. One is in the Court of Appeals decision is in 212 with second, the Supreme Court decision is in 216 with second, and they did not apply a bar. And we submit intuitively this makes sense because the whole theory of opening the door is that a bar, what would be otherwise admissible, doesn't come in.
Your opposing counsel takes the position that even if the door is open, first of all, it has to meet any proffered evidence, has to meet hearsay objections, it has to be otherwise admissible, and she takes the next step that any proffered evidence then has to go through the five-part, is it, Pulisano test, and then still you have to show that there's a meet the compelling standard. You disagree with that array of hurdles?
Absolutely, because what it would mean is otherwise inadmissible evidence you'd have to show would be admissible, and it would, of course, be by the most stringent of standards. I think that really what Pulisano would involve in this case is if, in fact, the door was not opened, whether trial counsel was ineffective for not having litigated the matter. But one of the things that's really critical here, I think, in terms of this whole concept, is that in the mine run of cases, in sexual assault cases, the state is not hamstrung from making an effective presentation, because the state can introduce evidence from the complaining witness and expert testimony. And in fact, under Jensen, the state can introduce evidence relating to the complaining witness. However, it's our position that when they do that, they open the door to other
subjects. Doesn't your approach render meaningless the rape shield law then? I mean, it's irrelevant to your inquiry here. It doesn't even come into play.
In terms of opening the door, it could be the rape shield law, it could be any other bar in any other circumstance. And it doesn't render them meaningless, it simply means rather than the rape...
Renders shield, irrelevant for your inquiry.
Right. In other words, once you open that door, that evidence can come in. And in this case, it's fundamental. The whole suggestion of all of the evidence here is that Charles Dunlap... This is a person, there's been no showing in this record that he had, you know, there's no other acts evidence. There's no showing of anything connecting him to a sexual assault at any time other than the testimony of this person. So his defense to show another source of knowledge is critical.
Okay, if I could go back to my line of questioning, counsel. You said that it's your position that this evidence... should have been admitted, the evidence of her bizarre sexual acting out should have been admitted to show that she had previously been sexually assaulted.
I'm saying another source of knowledge which would suggest that, yes.
Such as what?
Consistent with sexual assault. Doesn't have to prove she was sexually assaulted. It would be consistent.
Another source of knowledge such as what? If not prior
sexual
assault.
Of sexual behavior and that kind of information.
Mr. Scherer,
another source of knowledge, such as what? If not sexual assault, that she had been previously sexually assaulted, what would that focus of the others?
Well, that's really the primary focus that she would have. There was an expert who testified post-conviction who did say that it could have been from exposure to pornography.
Okay, was there any evidence of that?
No.
Okay. Was there any evidence of anything else
No.
Some prior act which would have caused her to behave the way that she did.
No.
Then how is it that the Jensen evidence is relevant to anything?
It's
the reverse Jensen evidence we're talking about here.
In order to simply cross-examine, which is a fundamental right, involves the right to make a defense, the defendant can show it is relevant to whether he or someone else was involved. In other words, did she testify regarding this behavior?
Let me interrupt a minute. Jensen evidence is only corroborative evidence, right? It's not evidence of an act that occurred. I mean, that's what the Jensen case very clearly states, right? It's just corroborative of other direct or circumstantial evidence that some sort of act, whether sexual assault or perhaps, as you or your post-conviction expert suggested, inappropriate exposure to sexually explicit material, something like that. Jensen evidence is merely corroborative of that direct or circumstantial evidence of an act, right?
I think Jensen evidence can be interpreted, if it is not properly qualified, as evidence that would be as either a link in the chain or substantive evidence the assault occurred. That's my position.
So you wanted to be able to argue to the jury that she had been previously sexually assaulted, even though there was no evidence whatsoever of that on the basis of the behavior that she was exhibiting, for purposes of suggesting what? That your client didn't assault her on this occasion?
You wanted to be able to show to the jury that there was another source of knowledge, that there was other behavior, which is very unusual. I've never seen this behavior in years of practice.
Get at what? This gets back to the chief's question, because that's relevant to what?
I think it's relevant to whether or not the child sexual assault victim was correct in suggesting these behaviors as to Charleston.
I'm sorry, I couldn't understand that last part.
I think that these are relevant to whether these behaviors are consistent. In other words, it involves a connection between these behaviors and the acts of Charles Dunlap, or the lack thereof of some other person.
Counsel, I think the relevant issue here, at least for our discussion, is the credibility of this victim witness. The victim witness testified, has a statement soon after the event to the mother and to Ms. Hansen. It's a preliminary hearing, and there's also testimony at trial, and they are different. She says different things.
Correct.
And the effort is made, I think, by defense to show that she's not credible because she's changed her story. And what Ms. Hansen is doing is saying it's not unusual, at least one thing she's doing, it's not unusual for a victim at age 6 to not set forth every detail at every time the story is told. And that there's different understandings of the event, and so therefore it is told differently. So, as I see it, that's what she's doing, which is what was done in Jensen in terms of explaining that this kind of behavior by the victim is consistent with behaviors of other victims. I don't see that this is a question of source of knowledge. Now, that I have to get over that hurdle. And if this is a source of knowledge issue, then maybe the fact that she has other knowledge, other sources of knowledge, is important. But I don't see that in the bits of the transcript that at least are in your briefs. Where have I gone astray?
Well, Your Honor, it seems to me that the whole theory, first of all, I think it's important to note that one of the things that had been discussed was that, and I have not mentioned this in my argument, was, I'm in the red, can I continue?
You may answer, but speak up so I hear you.
Was the concept of in and out, and obviously one of the behaviors was masturbatory behavior, which would suggest she knew that. But more than that, the whole theory of her testimony was that Charles Dunlap had committed these particular incidents, and why the jury could fairly ask, why would a six-year-old, where would she have any knowledge of sexual contact other than this particular incident? And they do not know, and what we submit is they're required to know, is that this other information exists which could provide that information. Thank you.
Chief?
Ms. Justice Brasser.
Sorry.
On cross-examination of the little girl, there was an exposure of inconsistencies in her testimony.
That's correct, Your
Honor. All right. Now, how does the state come back and rehabilitate that through Jensen-type evidence without opening the door?
I think that they rehabilitate, Your Honor, by presenting what they did in large part, evidence of the general class of six-year-old sexual assault victims concerning their behavior. That's how they do it.
But where did she cross over the line? At what point?
I believe that the line was crossed by the prosecutor in this case by asking specific questions of the expert about behavior that is consistent with a sexual assault victim. And in doing that, it opened the door to the defense presenting other information of evidence to that effect.
You're making a distinction between a six-year-old and a sexual assault victim. I don't quite...
I don't think necessarily. I think they were just trying to show a child sexual assault victim generally of that age.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Roller.
A lot has been said by Mr. Shire in response to Justice Sykes' questions that this evidence was necessary to show an alternative source of knowledge. The state vehemently disagrees with this. The child's source of sexual knowledge is only a fact of consequence if jurors assume that young children are so naive sexually that the particular victim in this case could not have acquired the kind of sexual knowledge she testified about unless she had been assaulted by the defendant. The kind of sexual behavior we have here is fondling of the vagina. It's not anything as occurred, for example, in the Pulitzano case, where you've got a 7-year-old talking about multiple victim sexual assaults. You've got 4 children being sexually assaulted anally, orally, vaginally. When you have that kind of evidence, certainly a jury is going to jump to the conclusion that there is no way a child of 7 years of age is going to understand this unless this is the truth, what she's telling you is the truth. That's not what you've got here, and in fact, this court has recently accepted a case, the St. George case, which raises this precise question of what really is a source of knowledge kind of testimony. And if you really thought, if the defense really thought that this was necessary to get in under source of knowledge, then one would assume that there would have been a pretrial motion made and that the defense attorney would have tried to get this in under Pulitzano. That was not done. Defense counsel said, we wouldn't be here asking that this came in except for Hansen's testimony. Another point, Mr. Shire has on several occasions cited the State versus Jackson case, both in the Court of Appeals and in this court, for the proposition that, yes, the state, by its questioning, can open the door to evidence that's otherwise barred by the rape shield law. I don't think Jackson stands for this proposition at all, because I handled the Jackson case, and that was not a Pulitzano case. That was a case where the evidence the defense wanted to explore had to do with one of the exceptions to the rape shield law, prior sexual conduct between the victim and the complainant. So I don't really see how Pulitzano enters into that at all. As for Mr. Shire's contention that the Commonwealth versus Riley case supports his opinion, I believe that's from Pennsylvania, in that case, the state put on evidence of the victim's pregnancy. Well, the victim's pregnancy certainly relates to her sexual conduct, and obviously that would then open the door to similar evidence by the defense relating to prior sexual conduct. That's not what we have here.
would you address yourself to the question of what is and is not Jensen evidence in the first instance? Because it seems to me that that's a threshold matter here and in our next...
Well, I have to confess that this is one of the areas in which I actually find myself in agreement somewhat with Mr. Shire, because it's always been my understanding that Jensen evidence would be first evidence by an expert witness indicating that these are the types of behaviors that a victim of sexual assault are commonly observed in a victim of sexual assault, and that those behaviors can be reporting behavior, it could be sexually precocious behavior, it could be the whole spectrum.
Do you have a copy of the Jensen opinion?
Unfortunately, I don't have it with me, no.
Let me read you a paragraph from the very beginning of the case after the court sets out the expert's testimony in some detail. On review, the defendant challenges the admissibility of only one part of Mr. Bozeman's, that was the expert, testimony, namely Mr. Bozeman's comparison of the victim's acting out behaviors with the behavior of child sexual abuse victims, the acting out behaviors of sexual precocious behaviors, the misconduct in school, etc. So even though there was testimony in Jensen about the consistency of the victim's reporting behavior with the reporting behavior of other sexual assault victims, that's not what the case was about. That's not what the defendant was challenging. The defendant was challenging only the admissibility of the expert's opinion testimony about the consistency of the victim's acting out behavior, the sexually inappropriate behavior with other sexual assault victims. So there's a common misconception, I think, that exists about what is and is not real Jensen evidence properly understood.
Right, and I think you might be right that I know from talking to prosecutors and from reading transcripts that even in this case, the prosecutor talked about this as being Jensen evidence, and I think it's commonly understood and maybe misunderstood that Jensen evidence involves the whole panoply of behaviors, but another essential component is that you have to make the ultimate comparison. In other words, if you just get an expert up there to testify that this is how sexual assault victims behave, but the expert does not make the comparison between this general testimony and what was actually observed, then in my view, that's not Jensen evidence.
Well, let's see. What Jensen says is, we conclude that the circuit court may allow an expert witness to give an opinion about the consistency of a complainant's behavior with the behavior of victims of the same type of crime, only if the testimony will assist the trier of fact to understand the evidence or determine a fact and issue. So it's reactive behavior.
And has to be helpful to the jury.
And helpful to the jury. We conclude that an expert witness may be asked to describe the behavior of the complainant and then to describe that of victims of the same type of crime if the testimony helps the jury understand a complainant's reactive behavior. And the reactive behavior in Jensen was acting out in class or whatever. Only if the testimony, repeated, only reactive behavior, only if the testimony. Okay. That's your understanding of the case, of Jensen.
My time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Moeller. Thank you, Mr. Shire. That completes our hearing on 99-20.